just loved to get off school to go fishing. If his daddy said to him, you know, oh, you've a half day, such and such, well, he would have said, can I get off to go fishing, daddy? Or if you're fishing the weekend, can I go with you? Which was very rare for daddy and them to fish the weekend, or Michael, you know. But wee Michael just, he lived for the fishing. And he was watching that perfect storm with George Clooney. It came out shortly before daddy and them were killed. And he said to his mother, he says, Mummy, he says, you know, he says, whenever I get older, he says, and I become a captain of my ship, he says, my ship goes down, don't you cry, he says, because a captain goes with a ship. And them words hurt, really haunt Kathleen to this day, because, you know, she thinks to herself, you know, it wasn't that long before they did die that he had said this to her, and she was saying, thinking to herself, you try to interpret sort of things I'd said, well, did he mean that because he knew something, or silly, I know it's just probably silly, but everything goes through your head at a time like that.
An air and sea search is continuing off the County Down coast for three members of a family who left the port of Kilkeel in a small fishing boat early yesterday morning. The Coast Guard says the disappearance of the vessel has been upgraded from an emergency to a mayday situation.
Very calm, clear day. I mean, we have the saying, the cruel sea, and there's a sense of truth to that. Sea is unpredictable, you just never know. If something happens at home, you can, in a sense, assure you can run. But at sea, there's nowhere to run to. There's a life raft, a lifeboat. There is nowhere to run. You're left to face the sea.
So they hadn't been out since the Christmas. They were decommissioning. And the wee boy, and the three of them really, wanted to just have one more outing on the boat. And they decided they would go out on the 13th night, 14th morning. And that was it. They never come home. I was up that morning from 5 o'clock. Couldn't sleep. And there was nothing happened, nothing to draw your attention to anything, you know, that would have sort of been out of place. I watched all the boats going out, and you could even see the boats fishing off, you know, so there was nothing untoward that would have made you sort of say, God, there's something happened out there, you know. My father and them, I think, had to go out about 3:15, but they reckon they reached the grounds about between 5 and 5:30. So, that literally only reached the grounds when...
Three generations of the same family, a grandfather, father and son, all called Michael Green, are missing. The signs are not good. They left the port of Kilkeel, County Down, early yesterday morning to go fishing for prawns at the mouth of Carlingford Lock. Conditions were very calm at the time. The boy was on his half-term break, leaving him free to go on the trip. Concern grew when there was no communication from the vessel yesterday evening. A huge search operation involving fishermen and rescue services from the UK and the Republic is now underway.
Yes, I can remember getting a phone call saying there's a boat missing. And I remember coming down to the harbour, that the people were beginning to gather at the harbour to find out what was happening. I remember going to the Greens, remember being with them. The pictures are real in my mind. It's difficult to sort of know how to pray, especially when we know the lifeboat's out. We can pray for the safe recovery, but sometimes we know if a ship has gone down, there's no sign. There's no sign of a life raft. The chances of survivors is then limited.
We were extremely close, as I say. I mean, there only was myself and my two brothers when we grew up. And we were out on our own in the country, so I only ever had them to muck about with or carry on with, and that made us even closer. And, you know, nobody got past Michael. I mean, when I was going out with boys, it was they had to go through Michael first, you know. But in a way, I look back on it and I really cherish it, because I really had such a wonderful, happy childhood, and that overcomes the bad. Michael was 3 years older than me, but it felt like a year. As you get older, I suppose the 3 years seem nothing. But when we were younger, like, I suppose, you know, he did boss about a bit, like older brothers do. But, like, there's 5 years between Michael and Jeffrey, my younger brother, and that didn't seem to matter either, you know. The years weren't there, really. Michael was extremely young at heart. Always loved Christmas. Loved children. Totally adored children. And was like my father. He was totally devoted to his wife. They were just... Michael and Kathleen, to me, were a double of my own mother and father. Extremely happy. Didn't have very much, but were extremely happy. They had each other, and they had their family and their health. And we were all the same. I mean, we've all been brought up that way. If you have your health, you have everything. Christmas always wonderful in our house because Daddy and Mummy just loved Christmas. Daddy was only 20 when Michael was born, so he was a young granddad. For to have a 13-year-old granddaughter, he was extremely young, I suppose. And he had arthritic pains, or I mean, he had arthritis in his hip joints and 3/4 way up his spine. But in saying that, he did his best. You know, he would have joked with the children and carried on with them as much as he possibly could have. But full of fun and devilment, really. And Michael and Jeffrey both, and I suppose myself in a way, if I was honest, to take after him. Michael was had just got, on the Monday before he went out, he had just got a health check done for the long distance lorry driving, and he had got all clear and everything, and got his photographs and that taken. But his photographs were, they weren't Michael, if you can understand me. It was Michael, but it was a haunted look on Michael. It was really, they scare me even looking at them yet. They weren't the brother I knew. They're weird looking. It was like a haunted look on his face, as if, you know, this is me taking photographs, I might as well not bother. You know, it was really weird. I know it does sound weird, but he had his sea survival suit on him in the picture. So he had, and it was as if to say, you know, there's really no point in me getting these photographs. You know, it's just a haunted look on his face. It's just you interpret it out of the photograph. I mean, it's just not, I don't know if you've mentioned anything like that, but it's just what we look at in the photograph and we think, you know, because other photographs, he's always grinny and smiley and real cheesy, you know, but he wasn't in this one. He wasn't looking forward to decommissioning the boat. He was looking forward to being a lorry driver, yeah, but he'd never worked on land, ever. So, I don't know, I could never have seen Michael on land working. From school, he was on the boat. He was only fourth year at school, and he gave up his last year at school. I mean, he was going to fishing anyway, and he went straight to the fishing with Daddy. Wee Michael just, he was just a gem. A wee devil, but a gem. We lived beside him, I don't even know how many years, from he was born up till about 6 years or so before they died. So he was maybe 4 or 5 whenever we left Ballykeel Court. And he cried because we were leaving. Because there only was our family, Michael's family, in the estate to play with at the time. And I remember saying to the three of them, don't worry, you're coming to stay in my house tonight. You know, my first night in, I promised them at the start when we were building the house that the three of them would be staying with me the first night. And I think he thought we'd forgot. And he started to cry. And my husband, he broke down, he started to cry. So we went back down the road and took the three of them up. But he loved football and just a wee devil. I mean, they had a wee mini dash hound, two mini dash hounds. And One had just given birth to a wee pup, just in the January. And he couldn't wait to get this pup up to an older age where it would be able to tease it. And he was teasing it and it wasn't even hardly able to move, you know. But he was a lovable child, such a lovable child. Even though Daddy and Michael were getting out of the fishing, wee Michael was determined he was going to fish when he got older.
I think if you allow fear to dominate you, then you wouldn't go to sea. And so it's respect for the sea. They know it can be treacherous. They know it in a minute, in a second, a wave can change your life forever.
I loved the sea right up until about 1985. I started to sort of dislike it then. My uncle was drowned in the harbour. And I got a fear for it because I thought, if this happens in the harbour, what can happen out when they're out at sea? But I always prayed. I mean, that's the only thing you can do. I mean, when it's in their blood, you can't ever change them. There's always the fear, continual fear of fishing and the harm. I mean, the dangers are there. There's always that fear. No matter how big the boat is, it's small compared to the sea. And when you've only got that small amount of space and such a big expanse of sea, there's nothing really you can do. And out there, I don't think it matters. I think once you go into the water, it's so cold, you don't have much time. My sister-in-law phoned the Coast Guard to say that she wasn't able to contact her husband and my father, and that her wee son was on the boat. And my mum went up the road, must have been around 2 or 3 o'clock, and I mean, I had my three children with me at this stage, and they had supposed to be school the next morning. So I said to mum, I'll go home, leave the children off and come back in. But she was adamant I'd go home. And she went up the road, and Thomas lives just across the road, Daddy's older brother. Now, Daddy just looked up to Thomas totally. She went across, or she phoned Thomas over, and she told Thomas that Daddy and Michael and the child hadn't come in. And Thomas, I think Thomas came over to Mummy's, and Mummy went and got Jeffrey and Patricia. They lived up just up the yard a bit from Mummy and them. And at 5 o'clock, Mummy then phoned the Coast Guard and told them that, reported the same as Kathleen had done previously. And they said that they were already trying to contact the boat. And Mummy said, look, they've been gone more than 24 hours. You know, I'm really, really extremely worried. They've got an 8-year-old on board. And they said they were sending Nimrod out daybreak, so that's what they've done. So we got a phone call here at 5 to say that Nimrod was being sent out. 5 in the morning, 5 o'clock Friday morning.
And on the 15th of February 2002, we had a report of what was at that time a missing persons report, the three members of the Green family missing. During the 15th day, that certainly changed to a more serious incident, with the clear understanding that the Tullamore Lass had foundered, and the three members of the Green family, three Michaels as have become known as, perished. From a policing point of view, we were keeping in contact with the Green family, and we had a liaison, people identified to work with the families. Throughout the 15th, we became aware of pieces of the Tullamore Lass being discovered at sea, and that confirmed the tragedy had taken place.
It's important, I think, that people don't bring false hope. People talk too much sometimes and bring rather than leave it to those that are involved to deal with the problem and to answer the family, speculation is people speculate as to what is actually happening there, and they don't know. And that was one of the great problems we faced, was speculation. Done probably the best of intentions, but and maybe thought at the same time they're bringing comfort. But speculation can be dangerous. What do you say? You say little. Give facts. Straight facts as they are. And not to speculate. And not to bring false hope. Because they are looking for hope. But if you start giving false hope, and that hopes are dashed, that's cruel to them. So you try and bring the story back to them as it really is at that point in time.
I went down to the harbour on the 14th night with the new vehicle that we had bought, because I had said to my dad, with his arthritic spine, I said, you know, Dad, I called him Daddy. I said, Daddy, you know, it has heated seats. And this is a big thing, like, you know, for us. I guess it'd be great for your back. And I says, I'll be down at the harbour tomorrow evening to pick you up. I went down to the harbour. And we stayed till 1:30 in the morning. And I knew then. I knew we were talking bodies then. Because my father never, or my brother, never. There would maybe have been half an hour, never ever anything more. If they said they were coming in at 6:30, they were in between 6:30 and 7:00. They said they would be in around between six and seven. Well, you knew that's the time they would have been in. They didn't come in. And we watched every boat, me and my mother. I mean, I had been out to Callings and said, you know, we were trying to phone the boat, we can't get no answer. And there was 313 calls or something made to Michael's mobile that night. And obviously none of them were answered, because the clip was found on the one of the windows of the wheelhouse. And where I think the phone maybe was in his pocket, I don't know. I mean, he kept everything in a survival suit, which he wasn't wearing because he was in bed. No, we knew that night. We were talking bodies. Even Kathleen knew, yeah.
One man being lost is a tragedy for that family. But the Greens, obviously, with little Michael being aboard and with the hunt for the Torrimory lass, and it went on for such a long period of time, and then the question, was there bodies aboard? Weren't there aboard? And rumours going round as to what was actually happening made it very, very difficult. And, of course, it got high priority and publicity in the press, and this made it very difficult for the family. But again, talking to other families around, when there is a tragedy, it brings home to them their tragedies that they have experienced over the years. I remember one man saying, and he was in his 80s, saying, I can still see my crew in the water.
Looking back on it, it was like a daze. You know, I can't remember it. There's bits of it I can remember and bits I can't remember. Obviously, the Friday, the 15th was the big day that you do remember, and it'll always stick by you, because the plane was hovering over my own house out around the villa, out around the sea here. And you know, it seems as if you're living in a nightmare, and somebody's gonna pinch you and you're gonna wake up. You know, but it doesn't happen. It was just like a long wake. Because there was people continually coming. You know, it wasn't just the 2 days that people maybe seen on TV or whatever, or the day of the funeral. It was 8.5 weeks of people coming every day. And only for them people, we would never have coped. I mean, you were torn between two homes. I'm extremely close to both my brothers. But I used to live next door to my brother Michael. And I was really close to my dad. And I was up home every day, and I was at Michael's every day. And my other brother lives up home, so I was always seeing them every day as well. But you were torn between if you're not home, you felt guilty because you thought you should have been in Michael's house with Kathleen, because the girls as well, and Kathleen. And you felt then you should have been at home with Mummy when you were at Kathleen's and Michael's, you know, and you just were torn between the two of them.
Really, really, it became clear that the vessel had foundered, and using sonar and every available piece of equipment, they were searching square grids of the area to try and locate the Tully Murray Lass. And at the same time, everyone in the area wanted to help, and they were searching beaches to try and find some sort of anything that would be connected with the Tully Murray Lass to give us some sort of steer as to where the vessel was.
This is the thing: when there is a tragedy, people begin to gather. Families come round, the community comes round to support those that are going through the trauma. It's the same in every fishing village, every fishing port. As soon as they hear there's a tragedy, people are touched, and they would go and surround the family, and just to be with them and say, "Look, we're here with you." Sometimes, like the Grange, it went on. Prayers weren't answered immediately. We don't know why. We're praying the bodies would be recovered, and praying that they would find comfort and strength, and that the bodies would be recovered, and it would help them to bring comfort to them, that their loved ones was home, and that rest. Because that was important for them. They knew that point, yes, once wreckage was found, they knew they were looking for bodies.
You do fear it. I mean, every time they went out, when we were younger, like, we were a Catholic family. We were brought up. My father wasn't over-religious, but he was very strict at us going to chapel, going to confessions, communion, whatever. And he was adamant about prayers and what have you, very, very much so, as was my brother. But that was all we could do. I mean, Daddy, yes, I suppose he wasn't overholy, he was in a way, because he had everything blessed. The boat was blessed. You know, he had holy pictures in the boat. He had blessed salt in the boat. He had holy water in the boat. He had everything like that. But every fishing town or village or whatever, and every fishing family would understand by saying, yes, you do fear. Every time they go out around that pier, are they going to come home? I've always prayed anyway, but it was the one thing that kept us close and kept us going the whole time they were missing, was the prayers and the people.
It's now more than a month since the Tully Murray Lass disappeared. The Green family have now sadly accepted that they won't see their loved ones again. I'm joined on the line by Sergeant Elvin Leach, who's in charge of the underwater search unit in Kilkeel. You have located the boat. What can you tell us?
Well, the boat was located last evening by the fisheries protection vessel, the Ken Vickers. It was located by side scan sonar. We were immediately alerted to be on standby to go and investigate this sonar reading. We went to Kilkeel this morning at first light and went out aboard the Ken Vickers to a position approximately 7 miles east of Kilkeel. There we commenced our diving operation. We found on the bottom the wreck of a fishing vessel, which we identified as that of the Tully Murray Lass. She's sitting in 42 metres of water on a sandy seabed, and she's sitting upright. In our dives today and our investigations today, we have seen no signs of any human remains.
April the 12th, I accompanied Elvin and his diving team on board the Ken Vickers crew out to the dive scene 7 miles east of Kilkeel. And as I understand it, and as I say, it was an education for me, there was zero visibility at stages on the seabed, but nevertheless, his diver was able to recover Edward Michael Green, which is the grandfather, to the surface. Now, we understood, we knew we couldn't go back out again to the scene, and we knew it would be the following day, and I don't think there was any of us, including Elvin's diving team and the crews of the Ken Vickers. I don't think any of us had a peaceful night's sleep knowing that the family had one body home, and it was vitally important that the other two would be brought home as well.
Kathleen, young Michael's mother, had specifically asked me that if we had discovered the bodies, that we wouldn't leave young Michael down there on his own. So we made a conscious effort on the Saturday morning to remove him before his father. So we recovered him to the surface first, and then his father was recovered last, which was harrowing. It was really one of the hardest things that we have had to do, was to bring those bodies ashore to the family at Warren Point Harbour. And I don't think there was a dry eye on the quayside. All these supposed roughy-tufty policemen and roughy-tufty divers, and we were all standing crying our eyes out.
One of the bodies was found at night, and it was poignant, it was dark. And then the next day, I think my wife opened the curtains, and we knew by this time that the other two bodies was on the boat. And I think she summed it up as by saying it was like a resurrection. And I happened to say this to one of the Greens. So my wife just said this morning, it's like a resurrection. He said, that's funny. He said, I just drew back my curtains. He said, I just thought of it the same. He said, it reminded me of the resurrection, because it was around Easter time. And it reminded us of our Lord's resurrection.
Never forget it. I'll never forget it. My daughter, Michael's daughter, Stephanie, the second eldest girl, she was the treat to my daughter Michaela and Stephanie were both making their confirmation that year, and my youngest daughter was making her communion along with wee Michael, supposedly. But the confirmation was first to come up, and it was about 2.5 weeks before the confirmation. We decided, it was a Friday night, we decided, right, we're going to have to go and get something for confirmation, because we had nothing. You know, they still didn't give us much hope of getting bodies at that stage. And we didn't know that they had actually, the divers had decided to dive on the boat that night, that day or that evening. And myself, my mum, and my sister-in-law, Patricia, Jeffrey's wife, and Michaela went up to Newry to shop to see if we could get something up in the butter crane. And we were just into the butter crane when we got a phone call to say that Daddy's body was on board the Ken Vickers, which was the fisheries vessel that brought them in. And it was total mayhem to get down the road, you know. I know it was only from Newry to Warren Point, but it was just, it seemed like forever. And a Friday night in Newry is just chaotic. So, yes, it would have been about 7 o'clock. So then we knew we had all planned where the bodies were going, because we wanted it as private as possible. I mean, nobody knew they were going to Warren Point, because we thought if we bring them to Kilkeel, it'll be all press, and we just felt we needed time on our own with them. And then on the Friday evening, Daddy's body came up, but we weren't allowed near him. But it wasn't even that. They were in body bag. He was in a body bag, obviously. But we just wanted to go over. He was still wearing his boots. And we just felt, you know, it'd be nice to go over and say, you know, Dad, we're here. You know, we're here for you. You know, and I think Ronnie, the policeman, he was brilliant, so he was. You know, and I think he was doing it for our own good, really. He was trying to sort of ease it on us, that it wouldn't be so tough. you know, to try and go over and touch a body bag and knowing you can't open it. You know, I think that was...
So you were able to touch the body bag?
No. You weren't allowed near it.
Just from a distance?
Well, it was a few feet, 3-4 feet away. But it's a long distance whenever you haven't seen him in 8 weeks, 8.5 weeks. They brought Daddy's body up first. Elvin Leach, the head diver, he said to us that he brought Daddy's body up, obviously because Daddy was on top of the two other ones. So he said he thought it would be better, and he thought it would be what Daddy would have wanted, because he would like Michael and the child to spend the last night together on the boat. And on the Saturday, we waited, and at 4 o'clock, we got the phone call to say that they were on their way with my brother and my nephew. And it was devastating. It was very hard because the press tried again. I understand they'd done a great job for us. I mean, only for them, we would have been totally lost. You know, only for the press, you wouldn't have had the coverage. But it was a private time. It was a time that we needed on our own. And Michael's two girls, well, one, I think, maybe two, I don't know, two girls were there. And to see a father and son's body coming up in body bags, it's not a nice sight. You know, and knowing that the child was coming up, and he was the first one up, and Michael's body was on the boat, and these photographers were photographing wee Michael's body coming up. And it wasn't till the next day that we realised that the were photographers. We thought they were the boat that comes in ahead of the convictors to guide them into the moor point, but it wasn't. We didn't know who they were, but apparently they had paid somebody on the other side to let them have a boat or something. And we'll never know that. I don't know if that's right or not, but this is what we were told. And after that terrible shock of having to see the two bodies coming up, especially an 8-year-old and a 32-year-old man, or 33-year-old man, I'm sorry. Plus you'd been through the previous night of Daddy, and then Sunday morning you wake up and you open your Sunday paper, you don't even open it, it's on the front page, body bag. It was devastating. I mean, I do understand the way the press works, and I do understand, and we thank them immensely, but just that one day they could have just given us it.
It brought a certain type of closure, because it was important. They wanted their loved ones home, and they felt they could put them to rest. I remember a widow in her 80s saying to me, at least I know where my husband's body is, I know where he is, and some of his crew wasn't found, but he was found. At least I know where my husband is, and I feel sorry for those who don't know. And this was something that happened in the 50s, and when she was in her 30s, and this is 50 years later. Not knowing, but she knew, and she said, at least I know, I've got that comfort, and I've got that strength to know that my husband's body is at rest back home.
I mean, to be able to give them the burial that we know they would have wanted, it was great. You know, yes, we couldn't see them, I mean, the coffins were closed, but we all got to put in our wee bits that we felt made us, you know, sort of, maybe people would think it's strange, but we've been photographs of the children and that, and wee notes and silly wee things, I suppose, but they meant a lot to us. You know, whenever you go into a room, and there's two in my brother's house, there was a white coffin and a wooden brown coffin with lids on. To me, it was two boxes, and my sister-in-law say the same. And in my father's house, it was a wooden box. I wanted to see my dad. I didn't want to see a coffin. I wanted to see my brother and my nephew. Give them a kiss and say, we love you. We'll see you again. But
thought it wasn't meant to be. I mean, they were very private people. And maybe that was the reason that the coffins were closed, or, you know, the reason that they were so long away was because they didn't want to be found. They wanted the coffins to be closed. I don't know. I mean, I'll never know. Hopefully one day we do see them again.
I think there's very little one can say to them. You're alongside them. You listen to them rather than me trying to talk. I think it's important I listen to them and let them talk, let them express their feelings. There's no words really to say, just to be alongside and to say, look, we're thinking of you, we're there with you, the community's there with you, and we seek to bring comfort, we're praying for you, just to reassure them that we are praying for them and we're alongside them. I think sometimes they can't pray themselves, perhaps. They don't know what to pray. Their mind's in a turmoil. And you're there supporting them, just to be there. I think it's like the poem, you know, the footsteps. And you look back and say, there's only one set. And where the Lord says, well, that was my set. I was carrying you. And we have to do that ministry of carrying them through that tragedy and help them through it. Because their mind's in a turmoil, physically, mentally, spiritually. Why? And there's no answer. There's no answer to that why. We don't know.
Oh, you continually ask yourself. I mean, myself and my sister-in-law, we are extremely close. I mean, we were close anyway, but now that Michael has gone, we're really close. Myself and her would be, if I'm not in her house, she's in my house, so it would be a talk about, it's always Michael, the child and daddy. It always, you know, comes back to that, and if they had been here, and how did they cope, or, you know, what really happened. You know, you're always asking yourself that. For my sister-in-law, Kathleen, and for my mum, and for all of us, I mean, Jeffrey, myself, you know, the children have been through hell and back, all of us, you know, because we were such a close, really, really close-knit family. It has been hell, because you're continually asking yourself, you know, did they suffer, or was it quick? And then you think to yourself, right, well, if they had time to get together, they had to have time to think. And you do, there's many nights you cry yourself to sleep. And my sister-in-law and her two wee girls, I mean, it's only hitting my brother's eldest wee girl now. And she keeps looking for her daddy. She has a picture above her bed that when she closes her eyes, it's him she closes her eyes to, and it's him that she wakes up to in the morning. And my mother just can't even go home. It hasn't got any easier. I mean, you just learn to live with it, but your pain gets deeper. Valentine's Day to Daddy was just another day, and Mummy. It's hard, but Daddy wasn't a romantic. He would have been in small ways, meaningful ways, not cards or flowers, but my brother was a romantic, big romantic, and he had left Kathleen the most beautiful Valentine's card, and with the most beautiful verse that he had wrote himself. He had worded it so beautifully. And Kathleen didn't give Michael her Valentine's card because she thought he would bring in. And that broke her heart. That really broke her heart. That she held on to that Valentine card for 8.5 weeks and put it in a coffin. But they would have been 13 years married in the June. And Michael never ever was out with another girl, only Kathleen. Kathleen was just his princess, as he used to say. She'll never get over that. I mean, my mum's heart found it extremely hard. And, like, she's not an old woman either. I mean, she's only coming 55 or so off this year. So her and Daddy, I mean, her and Daddy had never been out with anybody else, only themselves, each other, you know, that was it. So they were childhood sweethearts too, so, I mean, it does. It's devastating because both of them, both, you know, Kathleen, Michael, Mummy and Daddy, they didn't go anywhere without the other. It makes you wonder why people so good and so devoted to one another are taken, are separated. Why take the good, but then say the good always go first?